it's apt that the conversation starts with the differences, actually, that exist across the Atlantic. And I think one of the biggest is you all exist. You all believe that government should actually exist. We start with the base that we're not really sure we think government should exist. And that probably is a very defining factor of kind of just how we operate. And in many ways, what you will hear from me and what the U.S. has done, there are some lessons learned from it that have nothing to do with, per se, of exactly how to run programs or what to do, but some lessons learned more broadly that I think we can share across. But what you'll also hear is that in many cases, we've been taking lessons from what others have already been doing. So what's been happening in the UK, what's been taking place in the Danish government, what's happening in Australia, because we don't think we don't know that we had a lot of the answers, but we saw a lot of innovation taking place across countries, and we thought it was actually fairly important to integrate some of those ideas in ourselves. Although we will claim, as we always do as Americans, that we came up with all the ideas ourselves. one thing I would like to start with is saying, simultaneously, as you all have been looking at transforming the social sector, we began doing it about the same time. And this idea of transforming the social sector and how government can be involved and part of doing that it's partially driven, in many ways, driven by the budgets in general and kind of the economy in general. But partially, I think it was already coming to the idea that solutions to our problems, whether it's in education, whether it's in healthcare, whether it's in create job in and how do you train people for jobs, a lot of these problems have existed for a while and we haven't actually been solving them. We've been talking about them, but we're not actually solving them. And the bigger question, and I think it's been coming to a head in any case, is to say, if in business and in society we think about how do you reduce the cost to actually solve problems and how do you actually solve them, in the social sector we've seen a lot of proliferation of programs, but not actually solutions to problems. And lots of organizations working on similar issues. But when we actually sit back and say how many children got educated, and I'll give you some examples from the U.S. It's a little bit harder for me to take the U.K. examples. The numbers haven't changed. So 25 years in cities like Milwaukee, Wisconsin, in parts of Washington, D.C., the high school dropout rate has continued to remain at 50%. 50% of students are not graduating from high school, and the number of social programs have increased, and the question we have to ask ourselves is, what's the problem? Is it the programs we're supporting? Is it the way we're supporting them? Are there other things that we should be looking at? But really thinking about how do we solve some problems as opposed to just looking at the number of programs and the number of people served in those programs. And the one big game changer here to talk about is actually technology. Technology has helped in multiple different ways and getting information out to communities, in helping take in information about what's happening and what's not happening, what's working and what's not working, but also thinking about new ways of connecting to society in a way that we haven't been in the past and what are some ways of leveraging technology to do that. And that's something that we've tried to do in the U.S. government. We're just beginning the process of it, actually. It started just beginning of the process of it in the U.S. government, beginning to see other governments doing it. And frankly, it's in the emerging markets where a lot of the more interesting technological solutions are coming up, largely because they're strapped with even harder problems and even more ineffective governments. And so what they're having to do is to come up with solutions that technology has been helping pave the way for. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go forward. But let me start with just talking a little bit about my office. I ran an office in the White House called the Office of Social Innovation and Civic Participation. Very broad agenda, very broad office. But the idea of it was the president believed that we just needed to do business differently. We couldn't go in and come in. It was the hope and change agenda. We had to actually think about change, and we had to think about what we were going to do to change that. With that, you come in and you realize that government's a behemoth, and changing is hard, so you had to pick a few things that we were working on. And we sat back and thought about what are the things that government does. And one is government can scale big ideas, can scale ideas, but what we hadn't been doing is we'd been funding a lot of kind of pilot ideas, but we actually hadn't been scaling any of them. So lots of pilots across the government, across agencies in many ways, and we hadn't actually done anything to say what's working, where in the community are things working. And we strongly believed, with the premise on this, is that there were solutions. There were solutions that were working in communities across the country, in cities across the country, and we didn't know about them. This actually is probably one of the bigger differences between where the UK is and where the US is, largely because we're such a decentralized government that in many cities and states across the countries, people were coming up with innovative solutions, and they just weren't able to scale them. And that's something that we had to figure out how to get there, how to find them, how to scale them, and what are ways of doing that. So one way of doing that is finance. We are the largest funder, no matter what. The government is the largest funder of social service delivery in any country. And we had to, how do we think about financing differently? What are the financial models? What are ways of financing incentives differently? We incentivize currently, we provide incentives to count the number of people that walk through the door in a school, in a health clinic, in anything, but we never ask that question, did the diabetes rate actually go down for all of those people that walked in the door? But every year, the organization gets more money to serve more people because that's the incentive the government created. It wasn't the organizations, the nonprofit organizations or third sector organizations actually were meeting the incentives that were set up. They were doing what they were asked to do, which is serve more people. And that's exactly what they did. But they weren't asked the next question, which is, are we actually solving that problem? And that was one important way of us thinking about this. And the way we did that is first we created innovation funds in many ways, I think what the Big Society Bank here is doing. But looking to find the most innovative programs that have actually shown success and scaling them and giving capital for scale. The government didn't ask them to just report the number of people served and do compliance. But we actually asked the big question, which is, did the number of people that you were serving, did they actually meet a requirement? Have we actually solved a problem? Are more people graduating? Are more people reading? Are more children getting healthier? Those are the questions that we needed to ask. And that in that, we started to scale these organizations. We created it in three agencies as a start, at the Corporation for National and Community Service, at the Department of Education, and the Department of Labor. And those innovation funds, in the first year, were able to find some of the most innovative organizations across the country and invest in them. And I'll give you one example, an organization called Strive. This organization was based out of Cincinnati, Ohio, and they brought 240 agencies and groups together to say the dropout rate and the achievement rate between children in lower-income schools and children in higher-income schools has not gone down and has not changed in 25 years. Can we all come together and set the same metrics and the same goals to doing that? And in doing that, in 6 years, they were able to change that achievement rate because all of the organizations were following the exact same goals. They were all met. They were all focusing on the same goals. The agencies didn't do that, but this organization came together through the university that they did that. But it gave you an idea that innovation didn't require a significant amount of technology. It's quite a new way of thinking. It just really required a way of thinking about solving problems that we weren't looking for, nor were we actually financing in that way. And that was actually a fairly important lesson for us in understanding that we needed to be able to see what other people were doing. But once we defined the goals, it was a lot easier to find the organizations were doing that. The second, actually, we took an idea that was that's being implemented in the U.S., the impact bonds, the social impact bonds. We thought this idea that is being tested in the Peterborough prison was actually a very interesting way of thinking about investing in a solution. And I don't know if everybody knows about the Peterborough model, but it's actually a very interesting model. We put $100 million into the federal budget for 2012 to test this across seven agencies and letting people come to us with ideas, some variations of the Peterborough model of social impact bonds, so we could actually see if the same model applied in the U.S. or in various different ways would actually achieve the same results and what that looked like, and then share that experience with the U.K. and others so we can actually learn and then see what happens. But that was actually a really important way of thinking about how to use finance differently. But it also requires private partnerships, and it required a public-private partnership, so it wasn't just about what the government did, but also the private sector coming together. The second goal of the office was really looking at making information more publicly available and leveraging technology. Now, I know in the UK, you all have been already doing this with the transparency of information and putting more information out there. We hadn't been. We have a lot of information. Government agencies sit on so much information every day, and we don't let anybody know about it. Nobody knows what works. Nobody knows what doesn't work. Nobody knows how many organizations get served. Nobody knows who won a contract, why they won the contract, who got the grant, why they got the grant. All of that information continues to exist within our vaults, and nobody uses them. So the first piece of piece that the president put out was asking every agency to think about and to report in within 120 days how they were going to actually make more information transparent and what they were going to do about that, which is actually pretty important. And it created some very interesting ideas, and I'll give you one example of that. The Department of Health and Human Services, which I think is your Ministry of Health here, decided that they were going to make all of the CMS data. CMS is our is our Medicare, Medicaid data, which is the government-run healthcare system. They were going to make community-level data available, and they were going to make it publicly available. And as they were putting that information out, and they ran competitions with the private sector on how you might use this data to help communities know what their healthcare systems are, what was happening in their communities on a regular basis. And what was interesting, we had 15 companies compete, and 10 of them came up with great applications that communities started to use. So Denver, Colorado, Chicago, Illinois, Houston, Texas, all these different cities decided that they were going to incorporate this community-level data into, you know, which hospitals should you be going to if you needed this, which ones serve for flu, which ones had the best results. This information became really important, and that competition actually led to many more applications, many more companies wanting to be a part of it. One of the more interesting ones for me was one of the real estate companies started to incorporate health data as to where people might want to live when they retire or where they might want to live if they have young kids, because the best hospitals, the best caretaking was taking place. And these real estate companies were beginning to incorporate this into their. So we don't really know where all this data is going to be used as much as we sometimes think. And our challenge sometimes in government is we tend to want to write what everybody's going to use the data for or how they're going to do it, rather than just putting it out there and seeing what happens. And it makes us all very uncomfortable. It certainly made us all very uncomfortable. But that was actually an important aspect of putting that data out. One of the biggest things I used to hear from the agencies is, well, if people send us information and we don't know what to do with it, then people are going to be mad at us that, you know, we didn't respond to their inquiry or we didn't do that. And it's like, well, I'd rather have that problem than not putting that information out there, because then we can actually solve the next problem, which is how do we respond and what are effective ways of doing that. But that had been a barrier for many of the agencies to actually make that data publicly available. But making the data publicly available was actually pretty critical for us and really thinking about how to use that. But I'd say the next more interesting thing was using prizes and challenges as a way to come up with new ideas and showing agencies and showing government ministers for us as well as the White House what people do with data. Because we didn't know how people would use it, and it was actually creative enough that it allowed other people to see what was possible. In the Veterans Administration, the way they used prizes and challenges is they ran internal competitions. What was the best way to reduce costs for veterans' health care? And in fact, the first year, the secretary offered this, and they said, he said, if you will give me ideas on how we can do that, I'll implement the top three ideas. They had 700 submissions the first year. The second year, because they actually did implement the top three, they had 20,000 submissions as to how you could lower the cost through technology to providing healthcare in the Veterans Administration. And that actually just goes to show that sometimes innovation isn't just on the outside, there's a lot on the inside, and there's a lot of ideas from people internally as to what can be done because they see it on a day-to-day basis, but they're not necessarily asked to implement those ideas. So we found that innovation to be applied internally as well as externally. And the third is leveraging technology to solve other problems that we didn't think about. And we did this through partnerships, actually. We did a partnership with Johnson & Johnson, with all the military hospitals and all of the government hospitals, as well as all of the cell phone companies throughout the United States, to run a program called Text for Baby. And one of the things that we had found is that in the U.S., 20% of low-income women do not use the Internet. So they don't have access to the Internet, they don't use it, and the ones that do have access to it, I think very similar to some of the statistics here, they won't use it. So we've been putting all these services online, but they're not using it, and they don't know how to address when they're in pregnancy, they don't know what to do with it. So we took a program actually from South Africa, where they had been using a texting service to let people know what they needed to do during when they had to get their AIDS medication. And we applied it to the United States, called Text for Baby, to give mothers, expecting mothers, they can text in their number. They can text in the number and tell us what stage of their pregnancy is. And every week they would get a message, every week they would get a message on what they should be doing at that week of their pregnancy. And if they had questions, they could text in questions, and Johnson & Johnson and the health agencies would actually respond and give that information out. Now, this didn't require any money from the government, but it required a willingness to partner across all of the government hospitals, as well as across the military and government, both the Health and Human Services hospitals, as well as the military hospitals, to allow that information and to allow access to all of the people that came into the clinics. But it also required the cell phone companies to provide a free texting service for 2 years, and a university who's actually doing research on whether we can actually reduce maternal mortality and child mortality rates in low-income communities across the country because of that. But again, not an idea that came from the U.S., but something certainly that could be applied. But it's a new way of thinking and a new type of partnership that required us to just think differently. And the third part of our office really looked at the civic engagement agenda, the civic participation. How do you get people to get involved in communities on a regular basis? We have a fairly high volunteering culture. I think about 66 million people volunteer regularly on a regular basis in the United States. But we wanted more people to get involved in their communities and to solve local problems because government alone couldn't do it. And we know going in, we knew going into the financial crisis, there's no way we were going to solve this ourselves. One, we leverage technology again. How do you let people know what's going on in their communities and being able to engage directly? So we did not create this website. We in fact partnered with somebody else who created a third-party website that allowed communities to find out what was going on in their community. They just put in their zip code and 30 or 40 volunteer activities would come up so they could volunteer in their communities. Now, I mentioned that we didn't actually create the website because what happens sometimes in government is by the time we actually write the contract as to what the technology is that we want, the technology is already outdated. And it takes 9 months to write it, 9 months to put it up and put it on, and then by the time it comes out, somebody's already created it better. What we wanted to figure out is a way to create a technology that we didn't have to create, but that could be living and breathing and constantly changing based on what happened. And that there were some lessons learned in that because it was not an easy thing to do to get a free technology and to use a free technology. But it was important that we needed to find a way to get people to engage and to figure out how they might engage most effectively. Second, we use the bully pulpit most effectively, having the president volunteer on a regular basis, having volunteer days of service for most of you. For us, the Martin Luther King Day of Service is actually a pretty big one for us. And having people come out and volunteer on those days is actually very important in highlighting those people and bringing them in. We bring a group of people in once a month to the White House that are doing great things in their communities to highlight why we think it's important. And they come meet senior officials in the White House and they get a White House visit as a part of that, which is actually a nice way to show that this is important. And the third is partnering, and the next is partnering with foundations and philanthropies on how to engage more with that. So let me give you two examples of two philanthropies that worked with us very closely. The Bloomberg philanthropies worked with us in putting someone in Bloomberg Foundation brought 20 mayors together and said, if you put in a minister at the mayoral level that is working on volunteering and civic participation at your levels, we'll pay for the person to be on your staff for 2 years. So 20 mayors agreed to be a part of that pilot, and now we're up to 120 mayors who now have somebody in their administration who works on just volunteering and civic engagement at their mayoral levels. And one important piece on that I will say is while we can do a lot at the federal level, really where the action happens at the state and local levels, and having that partnership was actually really critical. The Rockefeller Foundation did very similarly, worked with cities who weren't a part of that, whoever wanted to have people in their staff that could actually work on that, they actually gave, they provided the funding for 2 to 3 years for somebody to be on staff to do that until the mayors could actually afford to pay for them themselves or find other ways to pay for that. But that was some of the partnerships that got created for that. And then it inspired a series of technologies that came out of it that had nothing to do with the government. So meetup.com started to create a whole bunch of meetups where you can go online and meet up with your neighborhood to go work on a social issue that was taking place somewhere. Or you could mothers would get together because they were having problems in their schools. But these types of new technologies continued to spur up throughout that had nothing to do with us, but there were ways for local communities and local areas that could come together in their own backyards and work on some of these issues. Well, and then finally, you know, but all of this to say that, again, while we did a lot of these things, a lot of this came from other areas, and we were able to look across countries, but look across our own country as well as other countries to see what was working and how we could implement some of these ideas. And Impact Bonds, the Big Society Bank, the Danish government's innovation group and how they're leveraging innovation internally, the Australian government and how they're using performance contracting to get to results in the social sector. And again, in the emerging markets, where some of the most interesting ideas are coming from, where they're using business models as well as government models to think about how can you have maybe a business model that also addresses social issues. And these are you know, water companies, education companies, hospitals that are providing low-cost services, but at high quality. And they're very popular. In both Kenya and in India, some of the best schools are private schools that are at $3 a day. And they're providing quality of service that the government public schools are not providing. or water that is being provided for $1 a day in some of the poorest countries. Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, India are some of the countries where they're being provided $1 a day, but the government can't provide that. But people are willing to pay for those services because they exist. And then most interestingly, I think what we all see in many of the emerging markets is mobile payments. Mm-hmm. The use of mobile payments to get to do transactions. So while we might think we're not a cash-based society, going to Kenya and using your mobile payment to pay somebody through your mobile phone is a very different way of thinking about that. But mobile is kind of the next generation of where the technology pieces are going. But while all these things all sound great, and I gave you a lot of snippets of interesting things that are taking place, I will tell you that there are no small challenges in making this happen at scale. And the first I would say is we need more people in government that actually think innovatively, not just at the federal level, not just at the White House, but they need to be in agencies, they need to be at state governments, and they need to be at the mayoral levels, because it requires enough people to translate all of the ideas into action at multiple levels. There's so much you can do at the White House, but we don't even touch enough people. We get the big bully pulpit, but we don't even touch enough people to be able to translate that into what happens at the ministries themselves and at the agencies themselves. Government still has a very top-down mentality. We still want to define how we're going to change the world, and then we want everybody else to implement how we're going to change the world. But the real question is, how do we think about being able to take some of those bottom-up ideas and those bottom-up solutions, and what does that mean in the operational sense? And how do you do that? Because in many ways, one of the things that I learned, at least when I went to government, is everybody wants to tell you what the problem is, and nobody wants to tell you what some of the ideas are for solutions. And that's hard, because you're constantly barraged with all the problems, and that's what you end up doing. But what you really need is some of the solutions, and what can you do to actually solve some of those problems. But we need to find a way of getting there. To keep saying that we can't do that is not a solution either. For us, you know, we needed some room from Congress to test and try new ideas. Our Congress, as many of you can tell by the politics that is currently going on, there was very limited room to actually do anything. And our budgets are so tight, and our budgets were so written so tightly, that if we wanted to try a new idea, we didn't have the flexibility to do that. For us, the stimulus package actually helped, because we were able to write in flexibility into the stimulus package that allowed us to test some of these ideas. But we need more of that. Fourth, we need lawyers who are willing to think differently. Every agency has a lawyer. I mean, every general counsel, when we first started trying new ideas, they were like, nope, can't do it. That was the general answer. And you know, one of the largest differences between the private sector and the public sector is if you go to the private sector and you go to your lawyer and you'll say, I want to do that, and they will figure out a legal way to do it. You go to the public sector and you ask a lawyer and they'll just tell you it can't be done. That's it. And conversation. What you need is actually people to say, okay, if that's what you want to get done, let's figure out how to do it within the legal frameworks that we have. And that, you know, while I can laugh about it, and I do laugh about it, it is actually a big challenge. And having lawyers in who can work in government, who can look at this structures and think about how to solve those problems, actually goes a really long way. And for me, one of the biggest advantages that I had is we had a lawyer at the White House who had worked in the tech sector, who actually worked with me every time we needed to get through the next hurdle to say, here's how you do it, and would work with the agency lawyers to help solve that problem. But that's just one. You need a lot of them, and we need a lot more of them. Fifth, we need philanthropy to think differently. Philanthropy has become in many ways like government. They're trying to solve all the big problems, but they don't actually think about the bottom-up approaches sometimes. And at least in the U.S., that's one of the larger problems that we have. They've become institutions in themselves. And they need to take the risk, frankly, that the government just can't take. It's hard to take taxpayer dollars and constantly be risking it, but philanthropy has the ability and the appetite, if they had the appetite, could actually test new models. If they work, bring them to the government to see if those can be scaled. We need civil society to work with government to define metrics for success. This system actually needs to work with everybody at the table, and civil society needs to work with the government to figure out what are the metrics for success, because actually we haven't gotten them right, and government hasn't been doing so well in addressing that, but we really need civil society's help to do that so we can get those right and actually measure ourselves to outcomes and not just the number of people that walk through a door. We need business to stop running CSR shops traditionally. It's not just about the PR. We actually need the skill sets that exist in business to actually solve some of these problems. Whether it's looking at you know, whether it's looking at how you might use technology differently, whether it's looking at how you might change the way a process works, whether it's looking at just the skill sets that are required are actually pretty important. And a lot of times, I will tell you, one of the biggest challenges I had was everybody was coming in to tell me about their PR. They needed some good PR, so they came in and said they could do something. Some of the most interesting successes for us were where the businesses, a company like Walmart, would come in and say, we can just shelve differently. We're going to put, you know, the light bulbs on these shelves because that's where most people are going to go to, and that's just, we can change the market in that direction. That's exactly what we need. We don't need more PR. What we need is solutions, and that I think CSR shops just should be thinking slightly differently out of that. And then finally, we need to scale good ideas. We need to stop looking at pilots on a regular basis. We've got so many pilots across the world, and we're littered with pilots with no scale. And we have to think about how we're going to do scale. And how we're actually going to make some bets and see if they work. And they're qualified bets because they've actually been tested. So we have to be willing to take some of that on and not just be scared to do that. And we know now that frankly the conditions have just changed. I mean, we're in a new normal. The new normal is budgets are going to be tighter, not for the short term, for the long term. If we have to solve our deficit problems, that's just the new normal. I know at least in the United States, that's where we're going to be at. It's not going to increase. Some cities are already going into bankruptcy. Some states are figuring out how they're going to operate, and the federal government is going to have to cut budgets. And we're already going through that debate right now. Technology is a game changer. It already has changed the game on products and services, but really thinking about how we can leverage that game change in the social sector would really go a long way to addressing social challenges. And we need to make a commitment that we can actually solve problems in the next decade to two decades and not stagnate and come back 20 years later and say, wouldn't it be great if we solved that problem? Because there is a potential that we actually will leave next generation worse off than the generation that we're in, and that is not an okay option. I think we have got to put some of those ideas on the table. We've got to take some risks, and we've got to make some bets. And that includes new financial structures. It includes new models of partnership. And it includes an appetite for risk. I mean, those are very important things that we have to do. But the opportunities are so great that it seems odd to be sitting here and talking about why aren't we solving our social problems, because we can. And each of those new financial models, if the capital markets can come up with these crazy complicated financial structures to sell, mortgage finance, what I can't figure out is why we can't leverage capital markets to help solve social problems. There's got to be a way of doing it, and why can't we use those really smart brains to actually applying it to addressing our societal issues? Partnership, we can't continue to operate in this model of transactions. I don't have the money to pay, so it'd be great if you paid, and if you don't have the money to pay, we'll figure out how the government can pay for it. We really need to think about where civil society, where the private sector, and where the government bring their skill sets to the table, because civil society has the ability to get to communities in a way that the private sector does not. The private sector has a way to think about aggregation in a way that civil society does not. And the government has the ability to think about doing the right thing in a way that neither one, the private sector is definitely not going to do all the time, but certainly civil society can think very small to think about how you can do it at scale. And that is that those three properties need to come together to address some of these issues. And those models need to change. We don't know how to do them. I don't know that anyone's actually figured them all out. But there's lots of interesting opportunities to think about where they are. And I go back to, we need appetite for risk. The structures that we currently operate in were created 50 to 100 years ago. They were created for the times of 50 to 100 years ago. They've changed. So does a traditional charity need to remain a traditional charity? Does a traditional business need to remain a traditional business? Can we come up with models that allow the charity and business models to work together in a way that can have a financial mechanism that allows the charities to do their jobs differently? There are ways to think about that, and they're already being discussed, and they're already being talked about, but we have to be willing to try them. And we have to be willing to ask that over the next decade, can we create those structures that allow the next 100 years to be built upon that? Or are we going to just marginally play around with the edges of the current structures and say, well, we'll try to change it here and we'll see if this will change? And we've been doing that for the last 50 years, but we actually can think about changing those structures dramatically. And I do think that we have the opportunity to do that, and I certainly hope we will do that. I know that the generation of people graduating from colleges today are doing that. I look at the business schools across at Harvard, at Stanford, at MIT, at some of these places. The single largest club in each of these business schools is the social investment or social enterprise sector clubs. That's 1,000 students in those clubs. There are no courses that serve them. They just all come together because this is what they want to do. They are starting to create programs and businesses around the world that are just looking at new models, and they're willing to take that risk to do that. And they're moving to countries that they don't even know where they are, but they're getting on those planes and they're saying, we can create a business that can create a new toilet. We can create a new water business. We can figure this out because there are ways to solve those problems. So why can't we engage a generation that has that energy? And we have the resources and, frankly, the wherewithal to open up some of those doors to make that happen.